I'd like to lead up to one of the more well-known suttas, teachings of the Buddha, the Bahiya Sutta, in which the Buddha gave a very summary teaching to a man of his time named Bahiya, and then do a guided practice related to that, talk about it, and then have our final sit of the evening, ending at 8:30. So first, I'd like to pass along to you a traditional metaphor about the importance of concentration and insight that has kind of an implicit important teaching in it. So it is said that we find ourselves in the middle of a forest of ignorance and suffering. And we want to get out of this forest of ignorance and suffering to a place of enduring happiness, liberated from our confusion and our suffering. And so we could take a razor blade and cut our way through the forest with it, but that would not be very effective. Or we could take a stick and cut our way through the forest, but that too would not be very effective. What's effective is to marry the two together, to marry the sharpness and precision of the razor blade and the heft, the power of a stick. That's what enables us to cut a trail through the forest of ignorance and suffering. The sharpness of the razor blade is like insight, discernment. And the heft of the stick is like concentration. The two together is what helps us cut a path for ourselves that can take us to the other side. Both are really important. Sometimes people emphasize insight alone, but if insight doesn't have a concentrated mind, a steady mind, a mind that can drop the spotlight of attention on one thing with laser-like power, keep it there, that insight is not very penetrating. It's not very liberating. Alternately, some people value transport experiences, deep absorption states, very blissful and so forth. But if we don't have insight as well, we're not ultimately free. The transport is temporary. We always come back again. And in fact, we need to have insight into the transient and empty and ultimately unsatisfying nature of even blissful experiences. Thus the combination of vipassana, which is insight, and samadhi, which is concentration. The two go together. Interestingly as well, in that metaphor, is the point that to get out of the forest of ignorance and suffering to happiness and wisdom, you don't need to cut down the whole forest. We just need to cut a trail. That is good news. We don't need, in other words, to get rid of all the unwholesome tendencies of mind. We don't need to completely clear our childhood pain. We just need to cut one path through the forest of ignorance and suffering. That has remarkable implications, including related to self-acceptance and self-kindness. And that metaphor, go to the second theme here, really links to a conversation I had with Frank this morning. He didn't know me, but I'm on the spot here. And he brought to my attention some of the problem with the Buddha's metaphor of cultivation. And I don't know, Frank, do you want to give a summary of what you said to me? For people here? And then I'll kind of play off of what you told me, which I've been reflecting on all day. is what was so, remember the, you know, I've used the metaphor of, you know, be aware of the, what's there, that's being with, and then pulling weeds, that's letting go. That's the half of wise effort that's about undoing the unwholesome. And then there's planting flowers. So I've used that metaphor, and the Buddha used that language as well. And what I was very haunted by, what Frank was saying, was this vision of tilling the whole land, creating this kind of sterile, moon-like landscape, you know, as opposed to planting the flowers, as it were, you know, the fruit trees, just where you wanted them, without having to transform the whole landscape. But that's what was appropriate agriculture. And in a way, in terms of practice, what a relief that we don't have to perfect the mind. We can still be Indian. You'll never perfect India. but we can build some temples, right? We can create some places of order. We can plant certain wholesome tendencies in the mind. Right? All we have to do is just cut a path. And that really, that takes me to the Bahia Sutta. And we can talk about this in a bit. But I want to thank you, Frank. That was actually quite provocative. The image of planting, you know, the, fill in the blank, the corn stalk, you know, right next to the last year's wheat, without having to till and disturb everything. Just put what we want right there. So, actually, leading into this part of the Bahia Sutta, I want to another bit, which is, if you've read much of the early teachings of the Buddha, the Pali Canon, there are basically two accounts that he gives that are kind of autobiographical, where he talks about the run up to his own enlightenment, and each one is about 4 or 5 pages long, basically, so fairly short, and they show up in a variety of other suttas. But it's the same 3 or 4 pages, really, you know, a few dozen paragraphs. And sometimes the order is a little jumbled, it kind of doesn't make sense, you can just feel it was handed down orally. But it really is the Buddha's voice talking about this. It feels very personal. It's kind of intimate. He's really talking about his own practice and his own process. And in one of the two accounts, he goes through a series of descriptions of practices he did that had mounting intensity. And in that description, there's a recurring phrase, which is what I'd like to draw your attention to here. And basically, he talks about various afflictions. For example, hindrances, like greed or hatred or doubt or anxiety or restlessness, what have you. Or various forms of self or ego, things that are problematic. And he asked the question, you know, rhetorically, did such and such invade my mind and remain? No. Such and such did not invade my mind and remain. It may have arisen. And the weeds may have been there, but they did not invade the field of my mind and remain. That's what mattered. They did not invade anything. So, to the Bahia Sutta. Bahia was a contemporary of the Buddha, most likely an historical figure. He was a major teacher himself. The time of the Buddha's life was a period of great ferment in India, religiously. Old forms were falling away, new forms were taking root. You get a sense of the time of, you know, mystics and sages and seekers and philosophers kind of everywhere and big blue. A lot of the early suttas in Buddhism basically are debates, essentially, between the Buddha and challengers who come to him and want to take him down a notch and show him the error of his ways, and, you know, there's a dialogue and so forth. So in that context, Bahia, someone of real realization himself, sought out the Buddha. And I believe I told you a very summary version of this, and I think the first night of the retreat. So he walked some distance. He came to the Buddha, who was walking about, maybe on alms round or finishing his alms round. And Bahia came to the Buddha and said, essentially, "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" And the Buddha replied initially, "Not now, Bahia." Bahia asked a second time, "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" And the Buddha a second time said, "Not now, Bahia." And then Bahia asked a third time, "Please, noble sir, may I have your teachings?" And traditionally, if you get asked three times, you're supposed to consent to the request. And this is the Buddha's reply that's been handed down to us. So for me, it's in a sense, in response to the request of a mature practitioner who's being persistent in, at a time when the Buddha has other things maybe to do, or not now, you know, other obligations, or it's not quite right, but okay. He's, in a sense, for me at least, my interpretation is the Buddha is essentially going, okay, you want the truth? Here's the truth. You feel like you're ready for the truth? I can see that you're ready for the truth. Okay, here it comes. And he says, you know, in response to, you know, what are your teachings, said, "Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the scene, there will be only the scene. In reference to the heard, there will be only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, or thought, the sixth sense, there will be only the thought." That's how you should train yourself. "When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in the heard, only the sensed in the sensed, only the cognized, only the thought in the thought, then, Bahia, there's no you in that." Notice the movement from person to self. "Then, Bahia, person, there's no I in that. There's no self in that. There's no you. There's no identity in that. When there's no you in that, there's no you there." In other words, when there's no you emerging, there's no you anywhere. You doesn't exist except when it apparently emerges. And then transiently, evanescently, like a foam evaporating, it bubbles away. When there's no you in that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between you, between the two. This, just this, is the end of all suffering. So I'll read it through just directly. "Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, there will only be the heard. In reference to the sensed, there will only be the sensed. In reference to the thought, there will only be the thought. When for you, there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in the heard, only the sensed in the sensed, only the thought in the thought, then, Bahia, there's no you in that. When there's no you in that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of all suffering." As the sutta has it, Bahia was actually enlightened on the spot. It was a ripe fruit, and that really did it. As a takeaway, there's not a necessity in this teaching to cultivate the entire field. There's no transforming of what's there that's necessary. This is a pure be with practice. It's pure mindfulness practice. There's no working with this. There's no pulling weeds or planting flowers. There's just seeing into the nature of it. And also, what may be seen or may be felt or may be thought, etc., may well arise, but when there is seen through it in this way, such that it is just what it is, you know, it's seen into its barest elements, it then does not invade the mind in any way. By seeing into it with this combination of vipassana and samadhi, and the sharpness of the razor blade and the power of the stick, moment-to-moment experiential phenomena, including painful, difficult phenomena, cannot invade the mind anymore. So here we have a practice that, for the Buddha, is the pith, is the essence of his teaching. This insight into the empty nature of phenomena, certainly experiential phenomena. So this is an ultimate teaching. So this is, okay, you want it? You ready? Yes. And it's immediate and direct and utterly basic and foundational and fundamental in our own experience. In the scene, there's just the scene. In the trucks going by, there's just the sound of the trucks going by. In the wanting a different kind of food for dinner, there's just the wanting of a different kind of food for dinner. Whatever, you know. In my realization, which I hadn't realized with Des, that I was going to, you know, be doing meditation at 6:45 rather than 7 and losing 15 minutes of sloth and torpor in the morning. There was just that, oh dear, you know, whatever. It does not need to invade the mind and remain. It's so direct. In the sensation of the hand on the thigh, there is just the sensation of the hand on the thigh. You know, in the sadness of being lonely, there's just loneliness and loneliness. It's as simple as that. I thought we could do a practice about this for a bit of time and then talk about it. Particularly underscoring the intersection of profound, sophisticated practice and something that's utterly elemental and available to us at any moment. In the heard, there's just a heard. In the sense, just a sense. So let's, if you could, I'll invite your attention to some things. Being aware of breathing. Be aware of the sensations of breathing as they are, and as you like, softly say in your mind, there is inhaling, or there is pressure, or simply just occasionally softly note what there is rising, falling. And allow there to be only sensation present. And also be aware that indeed there can be only sensation in the sensation. There may be other things happening alongside the sensation, like noting it. But in the sensation, there can only be sensation. Simply sensation. Using language in the mind is distracting. Just let it go. Simply abiding as sensation, in sensation. Expanding to the body altogether with different sensations on its surface and inside it, kind of bubbling into awareness. See if you can let those various sensations all over your body. Each one, you know, simply be what it is. few more minutes expanding further to include all of experience, including thoughts of various kinds. And seeing what it's like to let there be just the thought and the thought. In the herd, letting there be only the herd. Sound, and from the sound that can be sent to the sound, then there may be a thought about the sound, and there, in the thought about the sound, there can be merely the thought about the sound. Can be an overall attitude in the mind, and in that attitude there can simply be only that attitude. be what they are without resistance. And with this allowing, not making any content of awareness a problem. Example, and irritation. There need only be irritation. It doesn't need to be a problem. Or in the sensations of anxiety, there are only the sensations of anxiety. It need not be a problem. Moving through the mind, there can be only the aversion cascade, not a problem. Or in a longing cascade, there can be only a longing cascade. Again, not a problem. This nature, moving through the mind. Opening to an awareness of what this way of being is like. Which, if it's real for you, may include a sense of freedom. And need not be caught by contents of mind. Simply letting them be what they are. And also, perhaps in this way of being, some sense of peacefulness. Contents pass through awareness, but when they are simply what they are, awareness itself is not disturbed. what did you experience in exploring the Buddha's advice to the healer? Can you say more? Yeah. Could you play around at all with letting the thought be just a thought, letting there be just thought in thought? Okay. That's something one can do, is to. It's like going through the metta cognitive level all the time. It is what it is. And then there's this reaction to what it is. And then that reaction is just what it is. And then there's a reaction to that. And it's just what it is. But throughout, in the scene, in what could be only the scene, and there's an immediacy of the experience. Yeah. Buddha's instruction is not that in the thought it's just a thought, but rather in the scene there's only the scene. And that's an important nuance. So in the anxiety there's only anxiety. It's not that it's just anxiety or just pain or just grief. but rather it is wholly what it is. There's no diminishment of what it is. It is pain, right? It is agony. It is terrible sorrow. But, well, then, the problem part. Yeah, yeah. So then part two. So I added that. It's freelancing, maybe incorrectly, but I think it's embedded. It's that there could well be something to deal with, but it doesn't have to be generative of craving in the next sense. And, you know, a lot of these various prompts, some of them are going to work for you and some of them aren't. You know, like previously we talked about the word alerting. You know, alerting doesn't, you know, has connotations of alarm for some people. Maybe noticing is a better word. It's really okay. So this idea of it is what it is, but it needn't be a problem, is, if you can relate to that, for me it's just my attempt in, with my language to nuance the difference between there may well be something to deal with, and yet it need not be a problem in a sense of causative of suffering. Yeah, I'm getting it in a sense, the distinction you probably have heard, you know, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. That's what I mean. It can be pain, but it need not be suffering. That's what I was getting at. It needn't be a problem. And I think that for those of us that are very organized around solving problems, reframing things as it's a condition, and that condition may call for action, but it doesn't have to be held as a problem, as, for example, something that's wrong or bad or a mortal threat or causative of craving and the contraction into selfing. That's the nuance. I think when we make things problems, they invade the mind and the name. And when the condition is only the condition, and then we're dealing with the condition, moment to moment, there's still a kind of freedom in dealing with the condition. That's the distinction I'm trying to get at of this. Different way of saying the same thing, I think, that the Buddha is saying here is in what I've quoted of Ajahn Sumedho, who does a kind of noting practice around different things. It's like this. Pain in the toes is like this. Wishing the pain would go away is like that. Wishing that I didn't wish the pain to go away is like that. You know, thinking about, you know, whatever, you know, is like that. It's the same thing. It just is what it is. How about other people? What are your experiences? Yeah. Deep question, isn't it? And truly one I've reflected on. What is that? briefly. First, I think it's helpful to examine that in its phenomenology, which is fancy talk for just what's the experience of it. Right? And I think that feels or is, the experience of it is that it's emergent, it's transient, in other words, it comes into being. Right? It's there, it performs a function, and then when it doesn't need to perform its function any longer, it's gone. You know, that voice or that direction, that agency. Right? That's the experience of it, generally. And there are other variations on it. You know, I was talking to someone in an interview about going into a situation, and it's like a little voice, helpful, it says, slow down, shut up, don't do that, you know, or leave this relationship, you know, and what is that voice, right? And I think of it, I think experientially, it is kind of like I've described, something comes into being, performs a function, and then fades away, and it's a useful function. And I think that basically it's a member of the executive committee. You know, it's this partial subpersonality that has a directedness that's quite useful. And it's just one member of the executive committee. And the executive committee is just one part of the village of self, the village of person. That's what I think. And I think it's wonderful to relate to it like that. There need not be I in it. It's just, and it's a kind of I-like voice. You know, it has a I-ish quality to it. But we need, you can see this approach works for you, but framed in the Dharma at least, we need not, we can see it as simply a partial thing. You know, it performs a function, but it's not, we don't have to identify with it. It's tempting to, because it has this directing quality to it. But we don't have to identify with it. Other people doing the Bahia practice? Yeah. Thank you. And in this Bahia practice, one can also, for example, these sort of subtle orientations or perspectives or attitudes. In that attitude, you know, we should train thus, that in that attitude there is only the attitude. Or we should train thus in the direction to, in the directedness of the mind, that says, let there be only sound and sound. In that directedness, there can be only the directedness. There is only the directedness. Again, it's this continual process of letting things be what they are, acknowledging what's there without identifying with it, without complicating around it, without proliferating around it. And one can do that with regard to everything. You should train us that in consciousness, there is only consciousness. In a sense, I mean, the Buddhist view, which is consistent with neuroscience, is that awareness emerges in association with something that it contains, something that it represents, right? It's awareness, so it's not seeing mystic, Early Buddhism, consciousness is not seen mystically. And in neuroscience, awareness is not seen mystically. It's quite mysterious still in neuroscience what awareness is. But in the Buddhist analysis of the aggregates, it's just one of the five piles of stuff that constitute moment-to-moment existence. Right? And as one of those piles, it's not special. And it's okay. But in consciousness, there is only consciousness. There's still consciousness. And the point of it is the Buddhist teachings is that there's no you there. There's just what's there. If you really boil it down, there's sensation, there's willfulness, there's pain, there's hope that pain ends, there's plans to make pain end, there's awareness, there is awareness of awareness. What? That's there. But it can be simply that. Maybe that's a better word than just. Simply that. And when you're walking down the trail, right? And there are sounds, there are sights, there are wishes, there are memories and associations, there's coming back to the moment, there are all these things happening. And it's kind of, it's like a complex process. It's a little bit like a band, or a parade. We are human parades, It's like we go down, there are all these things happening, right? And they're all happening, it's fine. And it can be simply that. That's the Bahia Sutta. And in the rain, there's only the rain. There can be only the, and in the disliking of the rain, there's simply disliking. Maybe one more. But if I could just really, there's been a lot of, I've introduced a lot of content here, more than is probably typical on a retreat. A certain pace, I kind of took a chance with that, and it's easy to get spun out in all these different directions. It's really helpful to kind of bring it down to something elemental. There is sound, isn't there? There is sight, there is wishing, there is sensation, and there are subtle attitudes, there are longings, and there is love, and it can be simply the case that in that is simply that. And that is only that, whatever that happens to be. And all the multiple thats, because there are multiple thats that are arising at any moment in time in the awareness. It's simply that. And then see what it's like to move into that mode. And, the Buddha says that just that is the end of all suffering. See for yourself. And then how about we do a move towards some practice here as towards the finish of the night. Yeah. Yeah, I do. There are degrees, but I'll say it like this. I know 28 people who can be like that at least some of the time. At least for a moment in meditation, it's like that. It's just what's there is what's there. There's a moment, and sometimes there are many moments, even many minutes, in any given meditation on any given day, I bet you. And then there are people who really hang out. Thank you. I don't think there's awareness of every little part bubbling into consciousness. And I don't think of it as control, really. It's actually more a matter of non-resistance. Not resisting, not problemizing things. And yeah, there's a steadiness of mind. That's where that samadhi, the heft, comes in. There can be a continuity. But a lot, I think, frankly, in ways that you probably don't fully, most people don't realize, but the truth is, much of the time, they're in a kind of enlightened state. They're just there, it's all right. They're reaching for the salt shaker. For the few seconds it takes to reach for the salt shaker and bring it back, there's no problem, there's no craving, there's presence, there's benignness, no problem. And it's good to become increasingly aware of the many moments where there's just, things are just happening. It's okay. You know, they have a saying in ordinary mind. Ordinary mind is enlightened mind. Enlightened mind. There's a kind of ordinariness to non-problem, non-craving. But to realize that you're there already in many little slivers of the day. Little spaces, you know. And then this practice, of course, and the yoga, you know, is to be really, really, you know, fully. That's what the Buddha is saying. You should train yourself. Though. It's a progressive process. John, did you have a comment about that? All right. No brain, no pain. No self, no problem. Yeah. And what book is this from? The Wise Heart? Yeah. Psychoanalysis and Buddhism. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Having realized that I am born with and living on the world, I found myself freeing from design here as a thing. And I have a thing I know that I do not need to know. The main change within the mind is to be motionless and silent, responding quickly to each perceptual instinct. Spontaneity becomes a way of life, the real becomes natural, and the natural becomes real, and above all, thinking, perception, love, life.
And who is saying that? I've heard that quote. I mean, others saying that, I've heard it too. Nisargadatta? Yeah. Yeah. Nisargadatta, yeah. A non-dual teacher, actually a fellow who sold cigarettes all his life, and a very ordinary person. So thank you very much for sharing that. Yeah, so, again, kind of trying to come out of the complications about all this, down to the simplicity, you know. In sound is sound, in the emotion of whatever it is for you of responding to that quotation is that emotion. It is simply what it is. It need not be a problem and there need not be anything added to it. So how about we sit till 8:30 or something?